now. Detonate the reality bomb!
Change has come to America.
Some alien race to come down and threaten us.
Is the singularity near?
The military-industrial complex.
The truth is out there.
The seven mountains of the influencers of culture.
To be as gods, you know,
catapult to propaganda.
From a mostly secure, undisclosed, split-level location on a cul-de-sac somewhere in the heartland of America, this is A View from the Bunker. Now, here's Derek Gilbert.
Most of us have heard of the UFO crash at Roswell, New Mexico in June of 1947, but 8 months later, in March of 48, in another part of the state, there was another crash that we didn't hear about, and perhaps that was by design. Welcome to A View from the Bunker. I'm Derek Gilbert. Our guest has researched this for quite some time. He's actually released a second edition regarding this particular incident. He's got long experience in journalism and in journalism education. He's a professional writer, editor, photographer, professor emeritus at New Mexico State University, which, perhaps not coincidentally, is where Clyde Tombaugh, the man who discovered Pluto, taught astronomy until 1973. The book, with his co-author Scott and Suzanne Ramsey, is The Aztec UFO Incident, and it is our honor to welcome back for, well, first time in 4 years, Dr. Frank Thayer. Frank, it's good to have you back on the program.
Hi, Derek. Good to be with you. It's for old time's sake.
Yes. I think we mentioned during the last program that we first met through the internet as contributors to an online fiction site called Writer's Cramp, and which was based out of Canada. Our friend Robert Liberty, an old friend of yours, who produced an online publication of some really remarkable quality. And that group that he managed to assemble through there has managed to hang together as a sort of an informal email group through the years, exchanging notes and information about life, geopolitics, quantum mechanics, and occasionally unidentified flying objects. So the new book, The Aztec UFO Incident, released in December, published by Career Press. The Aztec New Mexico Incident, March 25th, 1948. What happened on that date?
Early dawn, two policemen going up the road, and they see this craft in the sky going up to the northwest, and they're following it. It's wobbling as it flies, and at the same time, a rancher closer to Aztec sees this craft going over his house, and it actually strikes the cliff on a mesa just north of his house. And sparks fly, but the thing doesn't crash. It lifts up and goes on north. He was so impressed that he went to a telephone, which is not easy to find in New Mexico in 1948, and made a long-distance call to Albuquerque, to the Air Force base there, to say what he had seen. Meanwhile, the police are trying to follow this. This craft goes straight north another 10 miles, and it settles down on a flat-top mesa about 11 miles from Aztec, New Mexico. And as it turns out, that this is oil country. There's oil wells all over that place, thousands of them. But the oil company had seen that there was some smoke rising from the mesa or in that area, and they sent some of their people out, 5:36 in the morning, to go check it out because there were drip tanks at the bottom of the of that particular mesa, and they didn't want a fire.
Yeah.
Well, these guys, 18, 19 years old, roughnecks, what do they know? They go out there in their truck, and they walk up on top of the mesa, and there is smoldering brush up there, but there's also a 100-foot diameter dull aluminum disc just sitting there, sort of leaning over about 5 degrees, and they didn't know what to make of it. They'd never seen anything like it. So what do they do? Well, guys, what does a guy say? Hey, guys, watch this. One of them gets up and walks around on it. And there's a dome on top of the disc. And he gets up close and he looks, and there's portholes. And he describes them later in an interview that I've heard as mirrored sunglasses, but there weren't no mirrored sunglasses in 48. And he gets up close to it, and he can see into the craft. And he sees bodies slumped over a console. And gradually, of course, even though it's out in the middle of nowhere, ranchers show up and some other people until there are about 16 people on the top of the mesa, including the policeman who had followed it. And they were there. They didn't know what to do until suddenly a helicopter shows up above the mesa. And the guy who told the story first, Doug Nolan, he says, I didn't know what was more peculiar to me. Was it the disc on the mesa or the helicopter? Because I'd never seen a helicopter before.
They were a new thing in 1948.
It was brand new. And so as the sun came up, it may have been 2 or 3 hours. We're not sure of the time frame. The military showed up in force. They stormed up on the mesa. They sequestered all these people, separated them, debriefed them, and said, you will never say anything about this. This is national security. And he packed them off, and they disappeared. But before that, before the military arrived, these guys were fooling around. They found a hole in one of the portholes. They say, and all of them, it was just the size of a quarter, just a hole. They don't know how it got in there, because it's obviously, if this came from space, it was pretty tough stuff. And we aren't sure who opened the saucer. But a pole was inserted through this hole, poking around in the cabin of the saucer. And they hit a couple of buttons on a far wall.
Hmm.
And now, we've all seen the movie, The Day the Earth Stood Still.
Right, yes.
And that's exactly how he described it, that the saucer just opened up.
But nobody stepping out saying, Klaatu, Barada, Nikto.
No, yeah. No, there's... Gort wasn't there.
Thankfully, and yeah.
But they looked in and say he saw these dead bodies at the console. But after the government arrives, they pulled out maybe 14 to 16 bodies. The number varies according to the account. And there you have it. The civilians were trucked off the mesa, sent away, sworn to secrecy, and so on and so on. And the government had it all their own way. They cordoned off the area and spent about 2 weeks getting this thing dismantled and sent away to Los Alamos, which was down the road to the southeast over the dirt roads and so on. About 150 miles, I guess, they had to take it. So that's how the saucer landed on the mesa. It wasn't a crash. It was a controlled landing, and yet everybody inside was dead. In 48... the idea of controlled flight was pretty new, so they didn't think that it could be done intelligently. But now we realize that a drone can go land anywhere without anybody around.
Yeah, yeah. This is, again, to give people a sense of where this is located, Farmington, Aztec is just slightly northeast of Farmington, New Mexico, correct?
Correct.
And that's
they're very close, and they're sort of connected now. The highway... there's malls all in between the two towns,
yeah.
But they're all together up there in the Four Corners, just where Colorado, New Mexico, Utah, and Arizona meet.
Okay. So by contrast, then Roswell is almost 5.5-6 hours southeast on today's roads.
You got it.
Yeah.
And of course, the Roswell crash took place a long way from Roswell, actually, closer to Corona, New Mexico. And again, in the middle of nowhere. And there was a lot of that in New Mexico at the time.
Hmm. Yeah. Now, a modern flatbed trailer will typically haul loads that are no more than 8 feet wide, 10 feet wide if you get a permit. Now, here you've got a disc that's 100 feet in diameter, and they've got to haul it across dirt roads to get it to Los Alamos. And they got to get it down off the mesa, correct?
Mm-hmm.
How did they manage that?
Well, the book, both books, both the 2012 book, the 2015 book, talk about moving the craft. The clue to this comes from Frank Scully, the 1950 author who first published the book Behind the Flying Saucers.
Hmm.
And if it hadn't been suppressed and ridiculed and turned into a hoax, Americans would have known about a landed flying saucer long before Roswell. Remember, Roswell didn't really get known widely until 1980.
Right.
But anyway, Scully said that the scientists told him that this flying saucer came apart in three pieces held together by interior pins. Now, I can't imagine how that worked, because when it was together, you couldn't see a seam, a bolt, a rivet. It all looked like one piece. But apparently it came apart in three pieces, so they were able to, I guess, put it vertically on these what they called the Dragon Wagon, these lowboy trailers that they used to haul tanks off the battlefield with. Now, the weight wouldn't be a problem because we have learned that most of these saucers were super strong, but they were also very lightweight. And so that is how it is presumed that they got the saucer off the mesa and spirited it away so no one will ever would ever see it.
Roswell didn't really come to the public's attention until Stanton Friedman wrote his book. And that, again, was, as you say, about, well, over three decades after the incident. Why has it taken over 60 years for the public to begin to know about the Aztec incident?
Well, as Scott Ramsey has said, that Roswell is like a bag of pretzels. I mean, Aztec is like a bag of pretzels. There were so many twists and turns in the story. Let's go back to when it was first revealed. University of Denver, 1950, March 1950. Scientist X gets up on a stage and speaks to a Science 101 class at the University of Denver at high noon. And he is there because the scientists originally scheduled backed out, got cold feet. Scully writes in his book, those people who would tell the secret for nothing in 1949 wouldn't tell it for $20 million in 1950. In 1949, they thought the government's going to tell everybody about this within a few months. And this is Aztec we're talking about. And so he gets up, Scientist X, who is Silas Newton, the oil man and geophysicist, tells the class there is such a thing as a flying saucer. His lecture was recorded on a wire recorder. And you, of course, would know the predecessors of tape recording. A wire recorder. And the quality is superb. We have that on CD now. And we can listen to his lecture to this group of students. And it was had a great impact. Just here was somebody saying flying saucers are not only real, but one landed within 500 miles of Denver. And so this is the way it starts. The scientists knew Silas Newton. Silas Newton introduced them to Frank Scully, who was famous, by the way. He was a Variety columnist and a well-known writer in the United States. And he was going to write the book. Here comes the spoiler. J.P. Kahn, a rich guy, never worked a day in his life, but he was a good writer. And he worked for the San Francisco Chronicle. He wanted to buy the story from Scully so he could get famous. Scully wouldn't play ball. So Scully's book comes out in September 1950, one of the first books after Kehoe's book in the summer of 1950, first book on flying saucers. And so Kahn made it his life mission to destroy the people who had this story. And he wanted to besmirch Scully. He wanted to destroy the reputation of Silas Newton. And he went to the FBI to see if he could get something on them. And it ended up, by 1952, that he'd engineered FBI charges that were prosecuted in a Denver district court for fraud against another oil guy. Now, oil men, I can't believe that any oil man is going to be totally honest. I mean, I don't think you can get rich being totally honest. You and I aren't rich, right?
That's a fact.
But I think that once the case went to court and Silas Newton was found guilty, never sentenced, by the way, he had to pay court costs, but they let the case drop. The whole goal of J.P. Kahn's vendetta was to destroy the Aztec story. And so by 1953, it had been judged that Frank Scully had been duped, that the flying saucer at Aztec was a hoax, and it never happened.
So the reputation then of Silas Newton was besmirched. Scully's book was essentially debunked in the public eye. Let's go back to the response of the military here, and the angle I'm looking at by asking this question is, you know, whether this was coordinated at some level. The military, you say, arrived a couple of 3 hours after the first roughnecks, the two roughnecks arrived on the scene. What was the, how did the military's response to this particular crash differ from what they did after the Roswell crash 8 months earlier?
Well, I think they had their act together 8 months later. Instead of making an announcement, they had it very well planned. They showed up, they shut everything down, and they debriefed everybody and sent them away, and they said nothing to anybody. That's why it was never publicized. There was never a report. They didn't talk about an aircraft crash or an oil field accident. Just nothing ever happened. And which is very wise of them. And let's face it, in 1948, with the Cold War just starting, probably you and I would have made the same decision. If we get this thing, we got to keep it a secret because it could be very powerful for us. We could learn a lot, and we could fight the Soviets. So I think that most of us would agree if we were on the Mesa and told to keep our mouths shut, we would keep our mouths shut.
Well, the attitude of people back in the day, let me rephrase the question again. You made a statement in our previous interview, and I'm going to put a link to that in the show notes, by the way, if people hadn't heard the interview from 2012 about the first edition of the book. There'll be a link in the show notes for that. But you made a statement there that made a lot of sense to me, and I think it's a good rule of thumb for anybody who does any reading about history, regardless of the period of time that you're reading about. You have to read history and try to read it with the worldview of the people who were living in that day and age. One of the biggest mistakes that we make in trying to read about historical events is interpreting it through 21st century eyes, especially 21st century Westerners. What was the attitude in the United States in 1948 regarding not just the existence of extraterrestrial craft, but our relationship with the USSR?
We have to remember the greatest war in history had just been finished, and all of a sudden that the ally of the United States in spring 1945 turned cold very quickly and realized that this was a dangerous movement, that Soviet communism was a threat to world peace. And so I think that the military would do anything they could to defend the United States, and most citizens were very patriotic. And if you believe the government in 1948, no one doubted the government. We can't imagine that today.
No.
It was true.
Yeah, things changed after Kennedy and then Martin Luther King Jr. at Watergate. And,
all that. That's right.
How many witnesses were there that the military had to deal with?
You know, it's very interesting that we've got the two interviewed witnesses that Scott got before they died, who told identical stories and yet didn't know each other. They were both on the Mesa that day, on the saucer and so on, that they all agreed that there were approximately 16 people on the Mesa, and two of them were police officers, and which is very interesting that they should both remember the same numbers. When you go to court and you have two witnesses who don't know each other and tell the same story, it's a very compelling witness testimony indeed.
So the military moved in and rounded everybody up, got them off the Mesa in a hurry, kind of hushed everybody up, apparently did a better job than what they did in Roswell in 47. But one aspect of the story that I guess echoes Roswell a little bit, but and then also multiplies it, is the presence of bodies in the craft. I mean, there have been reports through the years of a body or bodies perhaps in the Roswell crash, but what did the discoverers find in the craft at Aztec?
Well, according to Frank Scully, who had the testimony of the scientists who told him about it, they found the 16 bodies. They found some interesting artifacts of various kinds. I think they found what appeared to be something like a book made of parchment with hieroglyphic symbols that they couldn't translate, some kind of heavy water, and food tablets. But the bodies were very similar in description to what we have later learned about Roswell. They were little guys, fairly large heads, dark eyes, large eyes, and one-piece suits. And so this corroborates some of what we have learned about Roswell.
Hmm. Well, Frank, I'm going to have to ask, are you using a headset microphone there?
Yes.
And maybe rubbing against your beard. We're getting a little extraneous noise here.
Oh, there. How's that?
Much better. Much better. I have the same issue when we record TV using those little headset, little skinny headset mics. We have to make sure that it's away from the facial hair.
I got to crane and move the boom.
How about the documentation regarding the crash? What were you and the Ramseys able to find as far as paperwork, a paper trail documenting the existence of the Aztec craft?
Well, that was tough. There's a lot of things that dovetailed into it. And Scott Ramsey went into the biographies of scientists who worked with the government during the war and in secret work afterward. And because Frank Scully said that there was a Dr. G, who was a composite of 8 or 9 scientists who worked on the craft. So that was one angle. One other very interesting angle for your listeners, and that was the Edelweiss Cafe Sting in Denver. And in 1950, government documents show that they were out to buy some photos from somebody who said they had black and white photographs of the Aztec crash. And he wanted $1,500 for these photos. Huh. And they were trying to meet him in the bar of this hotel. And there's no way of knowing whether they actually scored that or it was a failed sting, but the Army and Air Force documents show that they had agents in place trying to locate this fellow and get these photos, and the word Aztec was mentioned in the military documents, which were declassified and became part of the story we wrote. The other stuff has to do with the discoverers of Aztec long after it happened. We have to mention William Steinman, who wrote the book UFO Crash at Aztec, A Well-Kept Secret. In 1982, he stumbled on the Frank Scully book in a California bookstore, used bookstore. And he got in his car, he drove all the way to New Mexico because he thought he wanted to find out if it really happened. And he was very fortunate in locating witnesses who remembered the event. And he went to the crash site, and he found all kinds of military artifacts buried there.
Hmm.
And he compared his notes, what he found in Aztec, with how Scully described the site. Now, Scully had never been to Aztec. None of the people he knew had been to Aztec, but the scientists told him where it was located and what the site was like. And we compare in the book what Steinman found as opposed to what Scully described. It matches perfectly.
Hmm.
So we keep seeing this happening. And there was a Professor Roy Craig. He served on the Condon Committee. Of course, you know about the Condon Committee, but your listeners may not. This was a committee formed at the University of Colorado specifically to destroy the idea that flying saucers ever existed. And he was one of this academic symposium. They had already decided what they were going to find. All they had to do was wait a year to publish their findings. But Dr. Roy Craig, who was on the Condon Committee, admitted to Scott Ramsey that he visited the crash site several dozen times.
Hmm.
Now, why would he go to this site that he knew about if he knew there was no such thing as a flying saucer? Doesn't compute.
Hmm. Wanted to be really, really, really sure there was no flying saucer, apparently.
Oh, I love it.
Now, you mentioned some artifacts, military artifacts at that location. What reason would the military have had to be there and leave evidence behind?
Well, of course, I guess the military have operations all over the place and exercises. But it wasn't a large mesa. It's not that big. But why they were there and why they buried all M1 Garand clips and C-ration cans. Yeah, it could have been hunters. It could have been all sorts of things. But there was so much of it, and it was all buried, which is the the military cleans up their sites when they're done. And the cover that you have on the 2012 book, you look at it, and Scott Ramsey noticed that, wait a minute, there are trees planted in a straight line on this mesa. And those people who were involved in the recovery say that you sanitize the site. You make it look as though nothing ever happened there. And that includes planting trees where the trees have been plowed under or disturbed. These are, again, little evidence points, but they all point to the reality of the incident. There's nothing that goes against the idea that there was really something that happened on that mesa in 1948.
What kind of physical evidence, other than the military artifacts that were left behind, what kind of physical evidence is there of this crash?
It's only speculative. You can go up there. I've been up there, and of course, it's a very popular place for Aztec residents to go bicycling and things like that. But it's flat. And if you look around and say, this flat space is a little bit bigger than 100 feet in diameter, but it's almost circular, just where supposedly the saucer set down. And it's right by the cliff. You can go up to the edge and look down to the bottom. And there's trees at the back part of the mesa, the scrub trees. But it just, circumstantially, it's a perfect place to settle a round disc. And there's also a concrete pad, anomalous concrete pad that was cast at the edge of the mesa. And no one knows what it was for. It has no other purpose. Ramsey drilled through it to see how deep it was and what was underneath it, had the concrete samples tested, and they were consistent with the period, but they'd have to do a lot more research to date it exactly. But this concrete pad would have been suitable for putting the foot of a crane against it to help lift the pieces that they put on the trailers and hauled off down the road.
Okay. And again, witnesses who saw the crash that night, well, I guess calling it a crash is perhaps a misnomer, because they said it was not really damaged other than the hole in that porthole, but it appeared to come down in a controlled manner. So being flown remotely because the occupants of the craft were deceased.
Yes.
Okay. Now, there have been those who've looked at the evidence from the Roswell crash, which, of course, again, is much better known, and have proposed a theory that rather than being of extraterrestrial origin, that the Roswell crash was actually a craft that we brought back over from Germany in the wake of World War II, along with some of the scientists who were smuggled out under Operation Paperclip.
Right.
Have you looked at the evidence for the Aztec incident in light of that evidence? And what conclusions, if so, what conclusions did you draw?
That's a good question. I think I've read a fair amount about the German connection, and the Germans did construct disc-shaped craft, and they had some very interesting things, but their propulsion methods were generally something that could be reconstructed. The Roswell craft, and I don't know much about what they found there, but the Aztec craft was absolutely without propulsion method. There was no vents, there was no intakes, there were no propellers, there were no rocket tubes. It was absolutely sealed, which meant that it had to be a magnetic field drive of some kind, which was far beyond even what the Germans were doing in World War II, unless the Foo Fighters were something that that the Germans actually created. So I think that even though the Germans did have some super advanced craft, we don't think that they were testing those at White Sands. They were, the V-2 rocket was the main vehicle that they were testing at White Sands.
Yeah, and certainly 1948, well, heck, when I was a kid in grade school in the late 60s, and my German heritage, my mother's side, was known, I started catching some teasing from kids who were still, you know, almost 25 years after World War II, teasing me about, you know, being half German. 1948, the presence of former Nazi scientists working in the United States on the U.S. government payroll would have been something that the government might have been an incentive for the government to hide the project that they were working on. But it again, they've done enough to hide it that we don't know for sure what they were working on entirely and whether these incidents fall into that category. Frank, we mentioned at the beginning of the program that you have had a rather lengthy career in academia, teaching journalism at New Mexico State. And as somebody who's been training people to go out into the media over the years, you've had a lot of contact with people in mainstream media, major media outlets across the country. Why does the UFO phenomenon, when it's mentioned at all, usually used as kicker material, you know, the funny joke that they tell before they kick it to the guy with the weather?
You know, I've asked people in Associated Press about this, people who are editors and so on, saying, why doesn't the United States press cover, or mainstream media cover, flying saucers? And they said, you know, we don't know. We just don't do it. And I think that the U.S. government so carefully conditioned reporters in 48 to 50, the fact that this is not something you report. It won't go well for you. It's like a pilot. If a pilot reports a UFO, his career is in trouble. And it's a secret that's hiding in plain sight, but is not reported. Other countries' press, I think that like in Brazil or
Mexico,
Canada even, that the flying saucers are reported more frequently, and not necessarily with the twist ending that it always turns out to be a meteor or somebody who drank too much of Quavit. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like that. But in the United States, it's still a taboo subject that you're not supposed to take it seriously. It's like if you're an astronomer, it's frowned upon if you believe in God.
And yeah,
which really inhibits their understanding of the universe. But that's my own opinion. And so I think that the United States main media has not covered flying saucers, but the new media does, and does it fairly well.
And it is surprising in that the media doesn't spend more attention on this. But of course, there are plenty of other media outlets that are happy to pick up the slack. I think Ancient Aliens is in its eighth or ninth season now. So
that's right.
Giorgio Tsoukalos is laughing all the way to the bank. And recent surveys indicate that more adult Americans believe that we've been visited by extraterrestrials than believe in God as he is defined in the Bible.
Okay. I didn't see that comparison.
Well, it's taking a couple of different surveys and looking at, you know, it wasn't a survey that was done comparing one versus the other. It's
okay.
You know, the National Geographic Channel, before it launched a UFO program, commissioned a survey, and I keep tabs on a survey group called the Barna Group, which surveys American Christians about what they believe. And so when you compare and contrast, okay, this percentage of American adults believes in, you know, God as he is defined in the Bible. This percentage believes that we're being visited by extraterrestrials. And look, there's four times more of them than there are people who claim to believe in God. So it's kind of strange, because even though we live in a country where the belief is widespread, it's still treated as though there's something wrong with you if you show an interest in the topic.
That's correct. And there's no university doing studies on UFOs. It's not acceptable. But in 1950, 33% of Americans believed that flying saucers were real. In 1980 and later, 55% of Americans believed that some UFOs were extraterrestrial spacecraft. And the higher the education, the more likely you are to accept that reality.
Sure, yeah. The belief that, you know, there are so many stars out there, we just have to have, there just has to be intelligent life somewhere else out there. The the scientific researchers who actually worked on the craft or the pieces that were recovered, did you ever track any of those guys down? Were you able to get any leads as to people who saw the craft after it was taken to Los Alamos?
Funny you should mention that, Derek. Just yesterday, we've stumbled onto a source who actually knows something about this, and this is going to have to come in an updated edition or whatever. This is somebody who knew somebody at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, mm-hmm. who accidentally went into a hangar and saw this disc, large disc, and was told directly before being told to keep your mouth shut, oh, this one is from Aztec. And they said, what? You mean down in Mexico? No, this is from Aztec, New Mexico. So this is in 1958.
Oh.
This thing happened. And this just yesterday, Scott Ramsey called me with this new source that he has interviewed. And it's going to be in, we know the building number at Wright-Patterson, and it's a 100,000 square foot building, by the way. And it's going to be a great story for an updated edition, I'm sure.
Wow, that's some interesting, that'll be interesting information to incorporate into the next edition. What were they doing at White Sands regarding any kind of secret testing? I mean, I know that New Mexico, the Roswell area, there was the only bomber wing that carried nuclear weapons was based at was it Holloman Air Force Base there?
That is Roswell Army Airfield, later called Walker Air Force Base.
Okay. So you've got a strange coincidence there in that these craft are showing up close to the one base in the entire United States Air Force that was handling the most advanced weaponry in our arsenal.
Right.
What were they doing at White Sands? And I ask this just because there's a personal connection here. Sharon's father was at White Sands for a period of years when she was a child back in the 50s.
Yeah, we talked about that on Writer's Cramp at one time.
Yeah.
And yes, White Sands Proving Ground is one of the largest proving grounds, 4,000 square miles or whatever. And it is right smack dab in the middle of New Mexico. And they tested all manner of things. But after World War II, the space program started right there. All they had were V-2s, the German V-2s, and they had a lot of them. And they began to modify from there. And they flew V-2s uprange, and some went the wrong direction. But they wouldn't go as far as Aztec. Now, one contact that I've met him too is a former state representative, wrote an unpublished book called Peculiar Phenomenon, in which he goes into some of the strange things that happened on White Sands Missile Range. The William Steinman book indicates several things that happened on White Sands Missile Range, or Proving Ground, whichever it was at the time, and of flying saucers, all kinds of things that never made it. A couple of the stories made it into the El Paso Times and other Las Cruces Sun News, but they were not very commonly done. And after 1950, of course, the lid was on, and these things were never reported again. But there, a lot of sightings were found at White Sands Missile Range.
Hmm.
And this is where Carl Lorenzen, who is the original founder of Aerial Phenomena Research Organization, APRO, started her work. She was living in Alamogordo at the time before she moved to Arizona. And so she apparently had seen some things, and she recorded a lot of stories from servicemen who worked at White Sands. So there's a lot of things that happen at White Sands, which is just over. I'm looking out my kitchen window at the Oregon Mountains, and right over the mountains is where White Sands is.
Hmm. It's a lot of territory there. I'm looking at a map of New Mexico there, and it's a big chunk of territory there at White Sands.
And it's a no-fly zone, by the way.
I'm not surprised, based on what they did there and the types of weaponry that they tested. I know that there were things that Sharon's father was never able to, I never met him, sadly, but she says that there were things he was never allowed to talk about. But he did give him a taste, which is a little unusual for a boy from coal mining country in Kentucky to come home with a taste for habanero and ghost peppers. So he did import that and brought that home to southern Indiana. So
good. It's good for you.
keeps the sinuses clear, if nothing else. What was unique about this Aztec incident?
I think if we contrast Aztec to Roswell, as Roswell was a crash and a second crash and a lot of confusion, Aztec was a textbook operation. You had the people, few people who saw it, not a lot. With Roswell, they have something like 600 witnesses now. With Aztec, you have a very small group of people who are privy to it, and they were sworn to secrecy. There's a few other families and so on that knew something about it, but they got it intact and they spirited it away, and that was done, and that was the end of it. So this is a story that was highly compartmentalized, and if it wasn't for William Steinman and then now Scott Ramsey, who the year that Steinman published his book, Ramsey began poking into it. He was visiting on his day job selling electric wire.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody said, oh, they're out at the old crash site. He said, what's a crash site? And they told him, and he went out there, and he decided in 1986 he was going to follow this through until he found out whether something really happened or not. And he ended up spending, by his own description, close to $500,000 of his own savings and everything in following this up, traveling from state to state and talking to people. And everything he found pointed to the reality of the incident. And that's where we got to the 2012 book. I didn't come into the team until 2009. So I've only been at it for 6 years. But everything there fits. There's nothing that's discordant.
Hmm. Now, it's interesting, as I look at the online Skeptics Dictionary, they categorize, and you probably have seen this entry, they categorize the Aztec UFO incident as a hoax, and they spend a lot of time focusing on the trial for fraud of Silas Newton and his partner Gebauer. What is your response to that charge, and why are there those who want to categorize this as a hoax?
Well, you see that the trial of Silas Newton didn't discover a flying saucer. It's just some scientists talked to him. He was charged with fraud against another oil guy who was really a crook as well, if Newton was. But Newton was a college-educated geophysicist, and he didn't have to be crooked to get rich. But the charge against Silas Newton and his companion, Leo Gebauer, was such that it had nothing to do with flying saucers. Now, in the court, they accused them of having a doodle bug, which is a device supposedly that finds oil, gold, whatever it is, the early metal detectors.
Mm-hmm.
And they accused them of selling a fake device, but they never proved it. And according to Newton, that the device that they were using found oil. And if the guy who accused him of fraud couldn't find oil, I don't know whether that was because of the device or because of the calibration capabilities of the guy who did it. But the charge, the court case, the conviction had absolutely nothing to do with a crash flying saucer at Aztec.
Mm-hmm.
The only connection was that Silas Newton made that lecture at the University of Denver in 1950. And so you can see how they tried to associate him with having either poor morals or being a crook, and saying, therefore, and it's not logical, because he was charged with a crime, therefore Aztec did not happen. You can't make that leap of logic.
Yeah. You can't, rather than refuting the evidence, let's just discredit the messenger.
I think that we find that happening a great deal, particularly in the UFO field, that people who see things are discredited and very often their reputations are ruined.
Another reason for people who might have seen something to keep their mouths shut.
I would.
Yeah. The research that you and the Ramseys have done over the years, what to you was the most convincing or surprising bit of evidence about the Aztec incident?
What sold me on it were those two witnesses, two old guys who were willing to tell the truth after being silent all their lives. At the interview, they both were failing in health, and they were, one lived in Phoenix and one lived in Las Vegas, Nevada. And they were interviewed and they told the same stories. And that for me cinched the deal. Their stories were so close. And how many times do you get two witnesses to tell similar stories, much less the same? It's almost impossible.
Yeah. The question, I guess, is how similar were they? Because sometimes when you talk to police officers who've interviewed witnesses after an accident, for example, if the witnesses' stories are too similar, then that also makes them suspicious.
Well, that indicates collusion.
Exactly right.
And these people didn't know each other.
Hmm.
And so the only difference, they may have had differences in maybe one or two people on the top of the mesa, but one of the things that Ramsey was particularly interested in was they both said there were two cops. Now, up in this corner of the woods, you'd think that it would take forever for one cop to get out from Aztec to the mesa, but two cops, and one of them was a state policeman, would seem almost impossible. And when you've driven around out there and seen how isolated it is, that you'll understand the concern. But no, those two witnesses, I think, are what swayed me the most. And so when I found that out, everything else began to fall into place, and we've never found anything that hasn't contributed to that conclusion.
Hmm. What conclusions do you draw from this particular incident? I mean, how has this research affected your worldview?
Well, I think that I always was kind of interested in flying saucers. I wrote some flying saucer stories when I was a reporter right out of college, and I sort of dabbled in it here and there. Got the APRO newsletter, went to Canada to teach for 11 years, came back, but then in 1980, when the Berlitz book came out, the Roswell incident, I bought that, and I immediately said right there, the only thing you need to prove the existence of flying saucers is one case you cannot refute. And after reading that book, I thought, I think Roswell is the one case that is real. And so move up another 20 years, and I found the Steinman book in 2005, 2006, and read that and said, you know, I'd heard about Aztec. I thought it was a peculiar story. It may have been a bounce off from Roswell. It probably never happened. And then I discovered all this evidence and said, this is as real as Roswell, without a doubt. And so there's absolutely no doubt. It's not a matter of belief. It's a matter of factual understanding that there are such things as flying saucers, and they do fly over. I haven't seen one, but I've talked to a lot of people who have, and it means that the United States is being visited by somebody from somewhere. And if we don't stop burying our heads in the sands, we may find a crisis someday, or maybe they're just going to leave us alone. I don't know.
Well, so hopefully we'll figure out at some point who they are. I've got my own ideas on that, but I have known you long enough, even though it's usually via email, that I've trust your judgment and find this really intriguing in that it was a very similar incident in some ways to the Roswell crash, handled apparently in a much more efficient manner by the U.S. military and the U.S. government. And so interesting to study from that perspective, because you can see what appears to be a real change in the response, almost as though the U.S. military had figured out, based on the lessons learned at Roswell, how to handle the incident of a downed craft that they didn't want the public to know about.
That's the way we figure it as well. Yeah. They got their act together, and I'm sure, you know about Kecksburg. They did the same thing. They moved in, they scooped up whatever it was, and they told people nothing happened.
Just reminds me that classic X-Files episode with Charles Nelson Reilly playing the reporter, the author trying to investigate the UFO incident, because there are elements from stories, famous UFO stories from throughout the history of UFO incidents, the modern era anyway, since 1947, that were woven into that X-Files episode. Much of it for comic effect, but I just half expect, you know, one of the witnesses to say, yeah, two men in black showed up. One looked like Jesse the Body Ventura and the other was Alex Trebek. So telling me that what I saw was the planet Venus. Dr. Frank Thayers, co-author of the book, The Aztec UFO Incident, is co-authors Scott and Suzanne Ramsey. Frank, where do people find a copy of the book?
You can get it today at Amazon, amazon.com. And it's right there for immediate shipment. And if you, there's the Aztec UFO incident, or the Aztec incident 1948.com. That's the website for the book. And of course you can go to my website, frankthayer.net, if you want more information, and we can find a way to get you an autographed copy if you need it. No, things like that. And it's cheaper than the original book. I think they're selling it for $17.99 because they printed so many of them.
It's amazing what economies of scale can do.
I know.
Well, we'll put links to where you can find the book and to Frank's website and also to the book's website in the show notes at vftb.net. Frank, good to talk with you again. We'll have to do it sooner than 4 years from now.
This is always a pleasure, Derek. I'm so glad to be with you.
The show notes are posted at vftb.net, and you'll find links there to Dr. Frank Thayer's website, and a link to where you can find the book, The Aztec UFO Incident, co-authored by Frank Thayer, Scott Ramsey, and Suzanne Ramsey. Now, as a Christian, obviously, I've got some thoughts on what may have been recovered there at Hart Canyon. I don't believe that we've been visited by extraterrestrials, but clearly a lot of Americans do, and that's why I address the subject. The National Geographic Channel, about 4 years ago, did a survey to promote a new UFO chaser show that they were getting ready to launch, and found that more American adults believe that we've been visited by ET than responded that they believed in the God of the Bible in a separate survey conducted by the Barna Group a couple of years earlier. So clearly this is a subject that attracts a lot of attention, which is why Giorgio Tsoukalos has had such a nice long run on the History Channel with his Ancient Astronauts series. So it's possible that what was recovered at Hart Canyon in 1948 was a deception that has some supernatural implications. It is also very possible that what we saw was technology that we had gleaned from scientists brought over under Operation Paperclip. And the guy Malone has put together some good evidence for that. And I'll put a link to that in the show notes as well, so you can consider that evidence that the craft that was discovered was in fact of terrestrial origin, and that the occupants inside, as with the Roswell crash, and this is the case that he makes for the Roswell crash in 1947, were humans that were considered expendable. Humans, in the case of the Roswell crash, possibly suffering from a condition called progeria, which results in a deformation of the human skull, a small stature. In other words, essentially the same size and shape that we've come to associate with alien grays. So that is a possibility as well. And I'll put a link again to Guy's presentation. He gave a good presentation on this at the Last Days conference in Nashville back in 2010. And he's posted all that to his website, alienresistance.org. So look for that in the show notes to consider that possibility as well. Because, as I mentioned during the discussion, in 1947, 1948, we were just a couple of years removed from World War II. And the idea that Nazi scientists on the American, being paid by American taxpayers, would have been a politically explosive situation. As I said, I remember very distinctly being teased in grade school in the late 60s. And I'm only half German on my mother's side. And my mother's side of the family's been in the U.S. since the 1890s. So, you know, even a couple of decades removed, there were still people who remembered World War II and didn't think very fondly of people of German origin. So in 1948, it would have really have been difficult, especially if it became known that these were guys who had been on Hitler's payroll just a couple of years earlier. But the bottom line of all of this is that something really did happen at Hart Canyon in 1948, March of 1948, Aztec, New Mexico, up in the Four Corners region. Something happened. It had been written off for decades as a hoax. The evidence suggests otherwise. What exactly happened? Well, that is still open for discussion. But knowing Frank for over 10 years, the book is researched, footnoted, and I think it will contribute to a healthy intellectual discussion. A couple of things in the news. As I record this on Thursday, the 21st of January, the east coast of the United States is waiting for winter storm Jonas to arrive. Here in the Ozarks, it just left us an inch of snow and some ice, which has kept us home for a couple of days. Probably could travel safely if we needed to, but discretion being the better part of valor, we've been working at home for the last couple of days. And we appreciate Tom Horn in saying, yeah, just do that from there. Use the webcam and record the update that way. The East Coast may, areas of the East Coast may get 20 to 30 inches of snow, depending on which way the storm tracks. Washington, D.C. about to get socked. This will be the first time, forecasters believe, since 2003, if I remember correctly, that the entire East Coast megalopolis, that's Washington, D.C., Baltimore, Philly, New York, and Boston, all up that coast, will receive a foot of snow or more. So it's not going to be pleasant. As many as 50 million Americans in the path of that storm. And we've heard from some friends out that way who live on modest means, who are heating their home with electric heaters, and if the power goes down, they're going to be in some distress. So pray for those in the path of the storm, because I'm sure they can't be the only ones. From the Appalachians east, it's going to be a very, very difficult weekend. News-wise, economically, looking ahead to 2016 is going to be a difficult year. This is the week of the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, which interestingly, at least to me, is the part of Switzerland from which my mother's ancestors originated. Yeah, they're of German extraction. Actually, I'd say we're probably German after about 1690-something when they emigrated from the area around Davos, lived in that very close to where Davos is today in the 1690s. I guess there's all kinds of wars taking place. That's a period of history I don't know enough about. But anyway, they emigrated from Switzerland to a small town just northwest of Stuttgart, lived there for about 120 years, and then moved to Russia at the invitation of Catherine the Great, discovered that that wasn't so great, and that's why they came to the U.S. in the 1890s, living on the frontier with angry natives, because that was still within recent memory of Little Bighorn, was preferable to living with the Cossacks in what is today Ukraine and Moldova. Anyway, World Economic Forum taking place in Davos. That was a weird detour, wasn't it? only Gilbert could take the World Economic Forum and turn it into a story about himself. Anyway, the elites of the world, the economic elites, are meeting at Davos, Switzerland, along with some of the people who want to hobnob with the rich and famous. Actor Kevin Spacey is there to give a presentation on what it's like filming House of Cards and pretending to be one of the economically and politically well-connected. Bono from the band U2, he's there every year. But the economic editor for The Telegraph in London, Ambrose Evans-Pritchard, whose writing I have followed ever since the Clinton days, because he wrote a book about The strange coincidences that connected all those mysterious deaths in Arkansas to Bill and Hillary Clinton. He writes on economic matters today, and he interviewed former chief economist for the Bank for International Settlements, a gentleman named William White, who said that in 2016, we're facing a wave, an epic wave of debt defaults, bank failures, in other words, companies that are holding big debts that are worth much, much less today than they were 18 months ago. The debt cycle is due for a round of deflation. We've got too much debt out there that's built on nothing but paper that's been traded back and forth rather than actual economic output. So White says that the only question facing us in 2016 is whether we can look reality in the eye and deal with the situation in an orderly manner or not. And because everybody's human nature being what it is, those holding the pieces of paper are going to try to get out for themselves what they can and to heck with everybody else. He made an interesting comment, Mr. White did. He said that jubilees have been around for 5,000 years, since the days of the Sumerians. And of course, we read in the Bible that the jubilee was prescribed for the Hebrews. It was part of the Mosaic Law. It was a jubilee year every 7 years, and then a big jubilee every 50 years when all debts were canceled, essentially. Everything reset to zero. And the intent was to try to prevent the kind of oligarchy that has developed around the world today. I seriously doubt that the banks holding on to promissory notes, IOUs, are going to look at the jubilee as a viable option for unwinding the massive amount of debt piled up around the world. So if I, and maybe I'm just a little pessimistic when it comes to human nature, but I think if anything, history would show us that people will look out for their own interests at the expense of others. And I would suggest the Christian worldview also suggests that that is the case. So I am thinking that the year will be more disorderly than orderly as we try to figure out what's going on. I mean, it's great when you drive to a gas station, you can see now places where you can fill up a tank for under a buck and a half a gallon. There have been a few spots where gas price wars have broken out. Houghton Lake, Michigan comes to mind, where a couple of stations were down in the 79, 69 cent a gallon range. Look, that's below cost. That, in fact, in some parts of the country, that's below the taxes that are being charged on a gallon of gasoline. So that isn't sustainable. The price of a barrel of oil, some of the benchmark desirable grades of sweet crude are now below $28 a barrel, whereas 18 months ago they were in the $80 to $100 a barrel range. And that's not sustainable either. Producers may keep pumping oil because that's preferable to letting the equipment just sit there, but it's not likely there's going to be much new exploration. And at some point, selling oil for less than it costs to take it out of the ground, because here in the U.S., the cost to extract a barrel of oil from the ground, depending on where you are, ranges from $60 to $80 a barrel. Especially in the shale formations, it's higher. In the Middle East, they can do it for, you know, $20, $25 a barrel. But again, this isn't sustainable. And at some point, you will have producers beginning to fail, drilling companies, exploration companies beginning to fail. And banks in the U.S. are holding a lot of debt, a lot of money that they are owed by companies who are in the energy business and who are really struggling right now. The Dallas Federal Reserve has told banks in the Houston area, which is the heart of the American oil industry, to avoid foreclosing on energy-backed loans, but instead to force producers and exploration companies to sell assets. The properties against which those loans were made were a lot more valuable with oil at $100 a barrel than with oil at $30 a barrel. So there's a problem there. And it will affect the entire economy. I mean, speaking from personal experience and getting to know some guys in the oil industry in Southern Illinois, which was poised for a takeoff And I didn't know this, but you know, I'm from Chicago. And when you grow up in Chicago, you think the world ends at Interstate 80. In the southern third of Illinois, the southeast quadrant, if you will, below Interstate 70 and east of Interstate 57, was the center of the U.S. oil industry 100 years ago. But most of those wells, now can't compete with the oil coming out of the ground in the Middle East or even in Texas or Oklahoma. There's a lot of oil in the shale underneath southern Illinois, and the producers there thought that they were ready for a boom like what was happening in North Dakota. But in order to drill a profitable new well in southern Illinois, the price really needs to be on the high side of 80, 60 maybe, but on the high side of $80 a barrel. So where prices are right now, things aren't going to happen. And a lot of the people who were putting on more personnel to work in the oil fields, to fabricate equipment for the oil fields, are now in the process of laying those people off. And a lot of the people who moved to North Dakota when the boom was at its peak, not just to work in the oil fields, but also to build housing for those workers and infrastructure, electric grid, water lines, sewer, roads, are now looking for work and moving to other parts of the country. And in Canada, the situation's even worse because even though the weak Canadian dollar has helped keep their oil more competitive, the fact that the Canadians import most of their fruit and vegetables and the Canadian dollar is weak means that their grocery, the cost for groceries have just exploded here in the last few months. And I've seen some prices people have posted in pictures to Twitter of economy-sized bottle of Tide going for $32. A single cauliflower costing $8. I mean, it's really ridiculous. So, economically, 2016 is looking like a rough year. And I'm not trying to spread fear, but just suggesting that it would be a good idea to be prepared. Get out of debt if you can, cut expenses if you can, and just hang on because it's going to be a rough ride. Coming up on A View from the Bunker this Sunday, Doug Woodward, continuing essentially a conversation that we just had with Benjamin Baruch on the role that Russia will play in prophecy and why it is a geopolitical threat to the West and to the United States. And specifically, where is this reflected in prophecy? Ezekiel 38 is a clue. The land of unwalled villages. We'll post that up on Sunday. Doug Woodward's new book, The Next Great War in the Middle East, will be available soon, and it looks like a really good read. I've got a stack of things to get through, and so maybe being homebound today and tomorrow is not a bad idea, not a bad thing. Next week, it will probably go up on Thursday, actually, next week. We talk again with Dr. Timothy Furnish, an expert in Islamic eschatology, especially Mahdism. He's got another new book out, another collection of columns with a slightly different focus. So this is collection of columns that he's been writing over the last 10 years. The new book called Sects, Lies, and the Caliphate. You see what he did there, religious sects. Sects, Lies, and the Caliphate. And that will be probably next Thursday, the 28th. His work is proving to be very educational. You hear a lot about what Sunnis and Shias believe and what they're trying to accomplish and so forth on the evening, the cable news networks and on conservative talk radio. But frankly, most of us in the West don't know what we're talking about. Well, Dr. Furnish does. So next Thursday, the 28th, Sects, Lies, and the Caliphate with Dr. Timothy Furnish. January 31st, a guest recommended to me by a listener, Dr. Scott Lively. His ministry is focused on defending the family as defined by God. And he's being sued for crimes against humanity for something he allegedly did out of the country, something that isn't even against the law in that other country or in this country, and is being prosecuted under the Alien Torts Act, something that was passed in the 1780s in the United States, a law that's still on the books and is being stretched and used by attorneys to mean something that it wasn't intended to mean to begin with. So we'll talk about what's going on with that suit and why, what the implications are if you can sue an American in American court, have a foreign entity sue an American in American courts under international law, is essentially what's going on. And then Brian Ganawa returns on February 3rd. He's got a new series of books out, beginning a new series called Chronicles of the Watchers. And the first entry is called The Dragon King. Begun reading it last night, got through five chapters and didn't want to stop, but at some point you just have to sleep, you know. Excellent book, and another look at what's going on in the supernatural realm, but transformed into a very compelling story based on history. So, yeah, we'll talk with Brian Gadawa about that. The book should be available February 1st. We'll talk and have that program for you on Wednesday the 3rd. Chronicles of the Watchers, The Dragon King, the new entry from Brian Gadawa and a new collaborator, Charlie Wynn. Our Bible study, the Gilbert House Fellowship, now two per week, one Old Testament, one New Testament, posted every Sunday by noon Central Time. You'll find those posted at gilberthouse.org. This coming Tuesday night on Skywatch TV, Dr. Michael Heiser. We got him in studio. We got 2 weeks with him. 30-minute interviews about his new book, The Unseen Realm, and the Divine Counsel concept. Why is it so important to understanding the narrative of the Bible? Skywatch TV is broadcast on the Christian Television Network, and Skywatch TV airs at 9:30 p.m. Eastern Time, Tuesday night. That's UTC-5. DirecTV Channel 376, Dish Network Channel 267, Glory Star Satellite Channel 117. Follows our friends on Prophecy Watchers, Gary Stearman and Bob Ulrich. And if you miss it, you'll be able to see it later on the Skywatch TV channel on Roku. A View from the Bunker is a production of Gilbert House and released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 4.0 International License. The opening theme is by Kevin MacLeod, www.incompetech.com. We wrestle not against flesh and blood. I'm Derek Gilbert, and this is A View from the Bunker.